She took two packets from the bowl and added them to the mug. Then she glanced around, at the formica table, the fluorescent lights, the normalness of the room.
What?
What?
Josie said. What's the matter?
I was just thinking that this doesn't look like the kind of place where you'd beat a confession out of someone.
Depends on whether you've got one to be beaten out of you, the detective said.
When Josie blanched, he laughed.
I'm just joking. Honestly, the only time I beat confessions out of people is when I'm playing a cop on TV.
You play a cop on TV?
He sighed. Never mind.
He reached over to a tape recorder in the center of the table.
I'm going to record this, just like before, mostly because I'm too dumb to remember it all correctly.
The detective pressed the button and sat down across from Josie.
Do people tell you all the time that you look like your mom?
Never.
She tilted her head.
Is that what you brought me down to ask me?
He smiled. No.
I don't look like her anyway.
Sure you do. It's your eyes.
Josie looked down at the table.
Mine are a totally different color than hers. I wasn't talking about the color, the detective said.
Josie, tell me again what you saw the day of the shootings at Sterling High.
Underneath the table, Josie gripped her hands together. She dug the nails of one hand into the palm of the other so that something hurt more than the words he was making her say.
I had a science test. I'd studied really late for it, and I was thinking about it when I woke up in the morning. That's all I know. I already told you, I can't even remember being in school that day.
Do you remember what made you pass out in the locker room?
Josie closed her eyes. She could picture the locker room, the tile floor, the gray lockers, the orphan sock stuffed in a corner of the shower. And then, everything went red as anger, red as blood.
No,
Josie said, but tears had cut her voice into lace.
I don't even know why thinking about it makes me cry.
She hated being seen like this. She hated being like this. Most of all, she hated not knowing when it would happen. A shift of the wind, a turn of the tide.
Josie took the tissue the detective offered.
Please, she whispered. Can I just go now?
There was a moment of hesitation, and Josie could feel the weight of the detective's pity falling over her like a net, one that only held on to her words, while the rest, the shame, the anger, the fear, seeped right through.
Sure, Josie, he said. You can go.
Alex was pretending to read the Town of Sterling annual report when Josie suddenly burst out of the secured door into the police station's waiting area. She was crying hard, and Patrick Ducharme was nowhere in sight.
I'll kill him, Alex thought rationally, calmly, after I take care of my daughter.
Josie,
she said, as Josie ran past her out of the building toward the parking lot. Alex hurried after her, finally catching up to Josie in front of their car. She wrapped her arms around Josie's waist and felt her buckle.
Leave me alone,
Josie sobbed.
Josie, honey, what did he say to you? Talk to me.
I can't talk to you. You don't understand. None of you understand. Josie backed away.
The people who do, they're all dead.
Alex hesitated, unsure of the right move. She could fold Josie tighter into an embrace and let her cry, or she could make her see that no matter how upset she was, it was something she had the resources to handle. Sort of like an Allen charge, Alex realized, the instruction a judge would give to a jury that wasn't getting anywhere in its deliberations, which basically reminded them of their duty as American citizens and assured them that they could and would come to a consensus. It had always worked for her in court.
I know this is hard, Josie, but you're stronger than you think, and...
Josie shoved her hard, breaking away.
Stop talking to me like that! Like what? Like I'm some fucking witness or lawyer you're trying to impress.
Your Honor, sorry to interrupt. Alex wheeled around to find Patrick Ducharme standing 2 feet behind them, listening to every single word. Her cheeks reddened. This was exactly the kind of behavior you didn't put on public display when you were a judge. He'd probably go back into the police station and send out a mass email to the entire force. Guess what I just overheard?
Your daughter, he said. She forgot her sweatshirt.
Pink and hooded, it was folded neatly over his arm. He handed it to Josie. But then, instead of backing away, he put his hand on her shoulder.
Don't worry, Josie,
he said, meeting her gaze as if they were the only two people in this world.
We're gonna make this okay.
Alex expected Josie to snap at him, too, but instead Josie went calm under his touch. She nodded, as if she believed this for the first time since the shooting had occurred. Alex felt something rise inside her. Relief, she realized, that her daughter had finally reached out for the slightest bit of hope. And regret, bitter as any almond, because she hadn't been the one to put the piece back into her daughter's face. Josie wiped her eyes with the sleeve of her sweatshirt.
You all right?
Ducharme asked.
I guess. Good.
The detective nodded in Alex's direction.
Judge? Thank you,
she murmured, as he turned and started back to the police station. Alex heard the slam of the car door as Josie slipped into the passenger seat, but she watched Patrick Ducharme until he disappeared from sight.
I wish it had been me,
Alex thought, and she deliberately kept herself from filling in the rest of that sentence. Like Peter, Derek Markowitz was a computer whiz. Like Peter, he hadn't been blessed with muscles and height, or, for that matter, any gifts of puberty. He had hair that stuck up in small tufts, as if it had been planted. He wore his shirt tucked into his pants at all times, and he had never been popular. Unlike Peter, he hadn't gone to school one day and killed 10 people. Selena sat at the Markowitz's kitchen table, while Dee Dee Markowitz watched her like a hawk. She was there to interview Derek in the hope that he could be a witness for the defense, but to be perfectly honest, the information Derek had given her so far made him a much better candidate for the prosecution.
What if it's all my fault? Derek was saying. I mean, I'm the only one who was given a clue. If I'd been listening harder, maybe I could have stopped him. I could have told someone else. But instead, I figured he was joking around.
I don't think anyone would have done any differently in your situation, Selena said gently, and she meant it. The Peter you knew wasn't the one who went to the school that day.
Yeah,
Derek said, and he nodded to himself.
Are you about finished? Dee Dee asked, stepping forward. Derek's got a violin lesson.
Almost, Mrs. Markowitz. I just wanted to ask Derek about the Peter he did know.
How did you two meet?
We were both on a soccer team together in 6th grade, Derek said, and we both sucked.
Derek!
Sorry, Mom, but it's true.
He glanced up at Selena.
Then again, none of those jocks could write HTML code if their lives depended on it.
Selena smiled.
Yeah, well, count me in the ranks of the technologically impaired. So you two got to be friends while you were on the team?
We hung out on the bench, because we were never put into play, Derek said.
But no, we weren't really friends until after that, when he stopped hanging out with Josie.
Selena fumbled her pen.
Josie?
Yeah, Josie Cormier. She goes to the school, too.
And she's Peter's friend?
She used to be, like,
the only kid he ever hung around with, Derek explained. But then she became one of the cool kids and she ditched him. He looked at Selena. Peter didn't care, really. He said she'd turned into a bitch.
Derek!
Sorry, Mom, he said. But again, it's true.
Would you excuse me? Selena asked.
She walked out of the kitchen and into the bathroom, where she pulled her cell phone out of her pocket and dialed home.
It's me,
she said when Jordan answered, and then she hesitated.
Why is it so quiet?
Sam's asleep.
You didn't pop in another Wiggles video just to get your discovery read, did you?
Did you call specifically to accuse me of lousy parenting?
No,
Selena said.
I called to tell you that Peter and Josie used to be best friends.
In maximum security, Peter was allowed only one real visitor a week, but certain people didn't count. For example, your lawyer could come and see you as many times as necessary. And, here's the crazy thing, so could reporters. All Peter had to do was sign a little release that said he was willingly making the choice to speak to the media, and Elena Batista was allowed to meet him. She was hot. Peter noticed that right away. Instead of wearing some shapeless, oversized sweater, she had dressed in a tight blouse with buttons. If he leaned forward, he could even see cleavage. She had long, thick, curly hair and doe brown eyes, and Peter found it really hard to believe that she had ever been teased by anyone in high school. But she was sitting in front of him, that much was true, and she could barely look him in the eyes.
I can't believe this, she said,
her toes coming right up to the red line that separated them.
I can't believe I'm actually meeting you.
Peter pretended he heard this all the time.
Yeah, he said. It's cool that you drove up here. Oh, God, that was the least I could do, Elena said.
Peter thought of stories he'd heard, of groupies who'd written to inmates and eventually married them in a prison ceremony. He thought of the correctional officer who'd brought Elena in and wondered if he was telling everyone else that Peter Houghton had some hot girl visiting him.
You don't mind if I take notes, do you? Elena asked. For my paper? That's cool.
He watched her pull out a pencil and hold the cap in her mouth while she opened her notebook to a fresh page.
So, like I told you, I'm writing about the effects of bullying.
How come?
Well, there were times when I was in high school that I thought I'd rather just kill myself than go back to class the next day, because it would be easier. I figured if I was thinking it, there had to be other people thinking it, too. And that's where I came up with the idea.
She leaned forward, cleavage alert, and met Peter's eyes.
I'm hoping I can get it published in a psychology journal or something. That would be cool.
He winced. God, how many times was he going to use the word cool? He probably sounded like a total retard.
So, maybe you could start by telling me how often it used to happen. The bullying, I mean.
Every day, I guess.
What sorts of things did they do?
The usual, Peter said. Stuffing me into a locker, throwing my books out the bus window.
He gave her a litany he'd already given Jordan 1,000 times. Memories of being elbowed on his way up a staircase, moments where his glasses were ripped off and crushed, slurs pitched like fastballs. Elena's eyes melted.
That must have been so hard for you.
Peter didn't know what to say. He wanted her to stay interested in his story, but not if it meant that she thought he was a total wimp. He shrugged, hoping that was a good enough response. She stopped writing.
Peter, can I ask you something?
Sure.
Even if it's kind of off-topic?
Peter nodded.
Did you plan to kill them?
She was leaning forward again, her lips parted, as if whatever Peter was about to say was some wafer, a communion host that she'd been waiting for her whole life. Peter could hear the footsteps of a guard walking past the doorway behind him, could practically taste Elena's breath through the receiver. He wanted to give her the right answer, sound dangerous enough for her to be intrigued, to want to come back. He smiled, in a way that he hoped was sort of seductive.
"Let's just say it needed to stop," Peter answered.
The magazines in Jordan's dentist's office had the shelf life of plutonium. They were so old that the celebrity bride on the cover now had two babies named for biblical characters, or pieces of fruit, that the president listed as Man of the Year had already left office. To that end, when he stumbled upon the latest issue of Time while awaiting his appointment for a filling, Jordan felt like he'd hit the mother lode. "High school, the newest front line for battle," the cover read. And there was a still image of Sterling High from a chopper, kids still streaming out of all the building's orifices. He absently leafed toward the article and its subsections, not expecting to see anything he didn't already know or hadn't already seen in the papers, but one piece caught his eye. "Inside the Mind of a Killer," he read, and he saw the much-used school picture of Peter from his eighth-grade yearbook. Then he started to read.
"God damn," he said,
and he got to his feet, starting for the door.
"Mr. McAfee," the secretary said, "the dentist is ready for you."
"I'll have to reschedule."
"Well, you can't take our magazine."
"Add it to my bill,"
Jordan snapped, and he hurried downstairs to his car. His cell phone rang just as he turned the key in the ignition. He completely expected it to be Diana Levin, gloating over her good fortune, but instead, it was Selena.
"Hey, are you done at the dentist? I need you to swing by CVS and grab some diapers on the way home. I ran out."
"I'm not coming home. I've got bigger problems right now."
"Honey,"
Selena said,
"there are no bigger problems."
"I'll explain later,"
Jordan said, and he turned off his phone so that even if Diana called, she wouldn't be able to reach him. He got to the jail in 26 minutes, a personal record, and stormed into the entryway. There, he plastered the magazine up to the plastic that separated him from the CO who was signing him in.
"I need to bring this in when I see my client," Jordan said.
"Well, I'm sorry," the officer said, "but you can't take in anything that's got staples."
Frustrated, Jordan balanced the magazine against his leg and ripped out the binding staples.
"Fine. Can I see my client now?"
He was brought to the same conference room he always used at the jail, and he paced while he waited for Peter to arrive. When he did, Jordan slammed the magazine down on the table, open to the article.
"What the fuck were you thinking?"
Peter's mouth dropped open.
She never mentioned that she wrote for Time.
He scanned the pages.
"I can't believe it," he murmured.
Jordan could feel all the blood in his body rushing to his head. Surely this was how people had strokes.
"Do you have any idea how serious the charges against you are? How awful your case is? How much evidence there is against you?"
He smacked an open hand on the article.
"Do you really think that this makes you look at all sympathetic?"
Peter scowled.
"Well, thanks for the lecture. Maybe if you'd been here to deliver it a few weeks ago, we wouldn't be having this discussion at all."
"Oh, that's priceless," Jordan said. "I don't come by often enough, so you decide to get back at me by talking to the media?"
"She wasn't the media. She was my friend."
"Guess what?"
Jordan said.
"You don't get to have any friends."
"So what else is new?"
Peter shot back. Jordan opened his mouth to yell at Peter again, but couldn't. The truth of the statement struck him, as he remembered Selena's interview earlier this week with Derek Markowitz. Peter's buddies deserted him, or betrayed him, or spilled his secrets for a circulation of millions. If he really wanted to do his job right, he couldn't just be an attorney to Peter. He had to be his confidant, and to date, All he'd done was string the kid along, just like everyone else in his life.
Jordan sat down next to Peter.
Look, he said quietly, you can't do anything like this again. If anyone contacts you at all, for any reason, you need to tell me. And in return, I'll come to see you more often than I have been. Okay?
Peter shrugged his agreement. For a long moment, they both sat beside each other, silent, unsure of what came next.
So now what? Peter asked. Do I have to talk about Joey again? Or prep for that psychiatric interview?
Jordan hesitated. The only reason he'd come to see Peter was to tear into him for talking to a reporter. If not for that, he wouldn't have come to the jail at all. And he supposed he could ask Peter to recount his childhood, or his school history, or his feelings about being bullied. But somehow, that didn't seem right either.
Actually, I need some advice, he said. My wife got me this computer game last Christmas, Agents of Stealth. The thing is, I can't make it past the first level without getting wiped out.
Peter glanced at him sideways.
Well, are you registering as a droid or a Regal?
Who the hell knew? He hadn't taken the CD out of its box.
A droid. That's your first mistake. See, you can't enlist in the Purphorus Legion. You need to get appointed to serve. The way to do that is by starting off in the education area instead of the mines, understand?
Jordan glanced down at the article, still spread on the table. His case had just grown immeasurably more difficult, but maybe that was offset by the fact that his relationship with his client had gotten easier.
Yeah, Jordan said. I'm starting to.
You're not going to like this, Eleanor said, handing a document to Alex.
Why not?
It's a motion to recuse yourself from the Houghton case. The prosecution strongly requests a hearing.
A hearing meant that press would be present, the victims would be present, the families would be present. It meant that Alex would be under public scrutiny before this case could go any further.
Well, she's not getting one, Alex said dismissively.
The clerk hesitated.
I'd think twice about that.
Alex met her eyes.
You can leave now.
She waited for Eleanor to close the door behind herself, and then she closed her eyes. She didn't know what to do. It was true that she'd been more rattled during the arraignment than she'd anticipated. It was true, too, that the distance between herself and Josie could be measured by the very parameters of her role as judge. Yet, because Alex had steadfastly assumed that she was infallible, because she'd been so sure that she could be a fair justice on this case, she'd gotten herself into a catch-22. It was one thing to recuse yourself before the proceedings started, but if she backed out now, it would make her seem flighty, at best, or inept, at worst. Neither one of those was an adjective she wanted associated with her judicial career. If she didn't give Diana Levin the hearing she was requesting, it would look like Alex was hiding. Better to let them voice their positions and be a big girl. Alex pushed a button on her phone.
Eleanor, she said, schedule it.
She speared her fingers through her hair and then smoothed it down again. What she needed was a cigarette. She rummaged in her desk drawers but turned up only an empty pack of Merits. Shoot, she muttered, and then remembered her emergency pack hidden in the trunk of her car. Grabbing her keys, Alex stood up and left Chambers, hurrying down the back staircase to the parking lot. She threw open the fire door and heard the sickening crunch as it hit flesh.
Oh my gosh, she cried,
reaching for the man who'd doubled over in pain.
Are you all right?
Patrick Ducharme straightened, wincing.
Your Honor, he said, I've got to stop running into you. Literally.
She frowned. You shouldn't have been standing next to a fire door.
You shouldn't have been flinging it open.
So where is it today? Patrick asked.
Where's what?
The fire.
He nodded at another cop walking to a cruiser parked in the lot. Alex took a step backward and folded her arms.
I believe we already had a conversation about, well, conversation.
First of all, we're not talking about the case, unless there's some metaphorical thing going on that I don't know about. Second of all, your position on this case seems to be in doubt, at least if you believe the editorial in the Sterling News today.
There's an editorial about me today? Alex said, stunned. What does it say?
Well, I'd tell you, but that would be talking about the case, wouldn't it?
He grinned and started to walk off.
Hang on, Alex said, calling after the detective.
When he turned, she glanced around to make sure that they were alone in the parking lot.
Can I ask you something, off the record?
He nodded slowly.
Did Josie seem, I don't know, all right to you when you talked to her the other day?
The detective leaned against the brick wall of the court building.
You certainly know her better than I do.
Well, sure, Alex said. I just thought she might say something to you, as a stranger, that she wasn't willing to say to me.
She looked down at the ground between them.
Sometimes it's easier that way.
She could feel Patrick's eyes on her, but she couldn't quite muster the courage to meet them.
Can I tell you something, off the record?
Alex nodded.
Before I took this job, I used to work in Maine, and I had a case that wasn't just a case, if you know what I mean.
Alex did. She found herself listening in his voice for a note she hadn't heard before, a low one that resonated with anguish, like a tuning fork that never stopped its vibration.
There was a woman there who meant everything to me, and she had a little boy who meant everything to her. And when he was hurt, in a way a kid never should be, I moved heaven and earth to work that case, because I thought no one could possibly do a better job than I could. No one could possibly care more about the outcome.
He looked directly at Alex.
I was so sure I could separate how I felt about what had happened from how I had to do my job.
Alex swallowed, dry as dust.
And did you?
No. Because when you love someone, no matter what you tell yourself, it stops being a job.
What does it become?
Patrick thought for a moment.
Revenge.
One morning, when Lewis had told Lacey he was headed to visit Peter at the jail, she got in her car and followed him. In the days since Peter had confessed that his father didn't come to see him, through the arraignment and afterward, Lacey had kept this secret hidden. She spoke less and less to Lewis, because she feared that once she opened her mouth, it would escape like a hurricane. Lacey was careful to keep one car between hers and Lewis's. It made her think of a lifetime ago when they had been dating, and she would follow Lewis to his apartment, or he would follow her. They'd play games with each other, waving the rear windshield wiper like a dog wags its tail, flashing headlights in Morse code. He drove north, as if he was going to the jail, and for a moment Lacey had a crisis of doubt. Would Peter have lied to her for some reason? She didn't think so, but then again, she hadn't thought Lewis would, either. It started to rain just as they reached the green in Lime Center. Lewis signaled and turned into a small parking lot with a bank, an artist's studio, a flower shop. She couldn't pull in behind him. He'd recognize her car right away. So instead, she drove into the lot of the hardware store next door and parked behind the building.
Maybe he needs the ATM. Lacey thought,
but she got out of her car and hid behind the oil tanks to watch Lewis enter a floral shop and leave 5 minutes later with a bouquet of pink roses. All the breath left her body. Was he having an affair? She had never considered the possibility that things could get even worse, that their small family unit could fracture further. Lacey stumbled into her car and managed to follow Lewis. It was true, she had been obsessed with Peter's trial, and maybe she had been guilty of not listening to Lewis when he needed to talk, because nothing he had to say about economics seminars or publications or current events really seemed to matter anymore, not when her son was sitting in jail. But Lewis? She'd always imagined herself as the free spirit in their union. She'd seen him as the anchor. Security was a mirage. Being tied down hardly counted when the other end of the rope had unraveled. She wiped her eyes on her sleeve. Lewis would tell her, of course, that it was only sex, not love, that it didn't mean anything. He would say that there were all sorts of ways that people dealt with grief, with a hole in the heart. Lewis put on his blinker again and turned right, this time into a cemetery. A slow burn started inside Lacey's chest. Well, this was just sick. Was this where he met her? Lewis got out of the car, carrying his roses but no umbrella. The rain was coming down harder now, but Lacey was intent on seeing this through to the end. She stayed just far enough behind, following him to a newer section of the cemetery, the one with the freshest graves. There weren't even headstones yet. The plots looked like a patchwork, brown earth against the green of the clipped lawn. At the first grave, Lewis knelt and placed a rose on the soil. Then he moved to another one, doing the same. And another, until his hair was dripping into his face, until his shirt was soaked through, until he'd left behind 10 flowers. Lacey came up behind him as he was placing the last rose. "I know you're there," he said, although he didn't turn around. She could barely speak. The understanding that Lewis was not, in fact, cheating on her had been tempered by the knowledge of what he was actually spending his time doing these days. She couldn't tell if she was crying anymore or if the sky was doing it for her. "How dare you come here," she accused, "and not visit your own son?" He lifted his face to hers. "Do you know what chaos theory is?" "I don't give a fuck about chaos theory, Lewis. I care about Peter, which is more than I can say for..." "There's this belief," he interrupted, "that you can explain only the last moment in time, linearly, but that everything leading up to it might have come from any series of events. So, you know, a kid skips a stone at the beach, and somewhere across the planet, a tsunami happens." Lewis stood up, his hands in his pockets. "I took him hunting, Lacey. I told him to stick with the sport, even if he didn't like it. I said 1,000 things. What if one of them was what made Peter do this?" He doubled over, sobbing. As Lacey reached for him, the rain drummed over her shoulders and back. "We did the best we could," Lacey said.
"It wasn't good enough."
Lewis jerked his head in the direction of the graves.
"Look at this. Look at this."
Lacey did. Through the driving downpour, with her hair and clothes plastered to her, she took stock of the graveyard and saw the faces of the children who would still be alive if her own son had never been born. Lacey put her hand over her abdomen. The pain cut her in half, like a magician's trick, except she knew she would never really be put back together. One of her sons had been doing drugs. The other was a murderer. Had she and Lewis been the wrong parents for the boys they'd had? Or should they never have been parents at all? Children didn't make their own mistakes. They plunged into the pits they'd been led to by their parents. She and Lewis had truly believed they were headed the right way, but maybe they should have stopped to ask for directions. Maybe then they would never have had to watch Joey, and then Peter, take that one tragic step and free fall. Lacey remembered holding Joey's grades up against Peter's, telling Peter that maybe he should try out for soccer because Joey had enjoyed it so much. Acceptance started at home, but so did intolerance. By the time Peter had been excluded at school, Lacey realized, he was used to feeling like an outcast in his own family. Lacey squeezed her eyes shut. For the rest of her life, she'd be known as Peter Houghton's mother. At one point, that would have thrilled her, but you had to be careful what you wished for. Taking credit for what a child did well also meant accepting responsibility for what they did wrong. And to Lacey, that meant that instead of making reparations to these victims, she and Lewis needed to start closer to home, with Peter.
"He needs us," Lacey said, "more than ever."
Lewis shook his head.
"I can't go to see Peter."
She drew away.
"Why?"
"Because I still think, every day, of the drunk who crashed into Joey's car. I think of how much I wished he'd died instead of Joey, how he deserved to die. The parents of every one of these kids is thinking the same thing about Peter," Lewis said. "And Lacey, I don't blame a single one of them."
Lacey stepped back, shivering. Lewis wadded up the paper cone that had held the flowers and stuffed it into his pocket. The rain fell between them like a curtain, making it impossible for them to see each other clearly. Jordan waited at a pizza place near the jail for King Wah to arrive after his psychiatric interview with Peter. He was 10 minutes late, and Jordan wasn't sure if that was a good thing or a bad thing. King blew through the door on a gust of wind, his raincoat billowing out behind him. He slid into the booth where Jordan was sitting and picked up a slice of pizza on Jordan's plate.
"You can do this," he pronounced, and he took a bite.
Psychologically, there isn't a significant difference between the treatment of a victim of bullying over time and the treatment of an adult female in battered woman syndrome. The bottom line for both is post-traumatic stress disorder. He put the crust back on Jordan's plate.
"You know what Peter told me?"
Jordan thought about his client for a moment.
"That it sucks being in jail?"
"Well, they all say that." "He told me that he would rather have died than spend another day thinking about what could happen to him at school."
"Who does that sound like?"
"Katie Riccobono," Jordan said, "after she decided to give her husband a triple bypass with a steak knife."
"Katie Riccobono," King corrected.
"Poster child for battered woman syndrome."
"So Peter becomes the first example of bullied victim syndrome," Jordan said.
"Be honest with me, King. You think a jury is going to identify with a syndrome that doesn't even really exist?"
"A jury's not made up of battered women, but they've been known to acquit them before.
On the other hand, every single member of that jury will have been through high school." He reached for Jordan's Coke and took a sip.
"Did you know that a single incident of bullying in childhood can be as traumatic to a person over time as a single incident of sexual abuse?"
"You gotta be kidding me."
"Think about it. The common denominator is being humiliated.
What's the strongest memory you have from high school?" Jordan had to think for a moment before any memory of high school even clouded its way into his mind, much less a salient one. Then he started to grin.
"I was in phys ed and doing a fitness test. Part of it involved climbing a rope that was hung from the ceiling. In high school, I didn't have quite the massive physique I have now."
King snorted.
"Naturally. So I was already worried about not making it to the top. As it turned out, that wasn't a problem. It was coming back down. Because climbing up with the rope between my legs,
I got a massive boner.
There you go, King said. Ask 10 people, and half of them won't even be able to remember something concrete from high school. They've blocked it out. The other half will recall an incredibly painful or embarrassing moment. They stick like glue.
That is incredibly depressing, Jordan pointed out.
Well, most of us grow up and realize that in the grand scheme of life, these incidents are a tiny part of the puzzle.
And the ones who don't?
King glanced at Jordan.
They turn out like Peter.
The reason Alex was in Josie's closet in the first place was because Josie had borrowed her black shirt and never returned it, and Alex needed it tonight. She was meeting someone for dinner, Whit Hobart, her former boss, who'd retired from the public defender's office. After today's hearing, where the prosecution had made its motion to have her recused, she needed some advice. She found the skirt, but she'd also found a trove of treasures. Alex sat on the floor with a box open in her lap. The fringe of Josie's old jazz costume, from lessons she had taken when she was 6 or 7, fell into her palm like a whisper. The silk was cool to the touch. It was puddled on top of a faux fur tiger costume that Josie had worn one Halloween and kept for dress-up. Alex's first and last foray into sewing. Halfway through, she'd given up and soldered the fabric together with a hot glue gun. Alex had planned to take Josie trick-or-treating that year, but she'd been a public defender at the time, and one of her clients had been arrested again. Josie had gone out with the neighbor and her children, and that night, when Alex finally got home, Josie had spilled her pillowcase of candy on the bed.
"You can take half," Josie told her, "because you missed all the fun."
She thumbed through the atlas Josie had made in first grade, coloring every continent and then laminating the pages. She read her report cards. She found a hair elastic and looped it around her wrist. At the bottom of the box was a note written in the loopy script of a little girl. "Dear, D-E-E-R, Mom, I love you a lot. XOXO. Alex let her fingers trace the letters. She wondered why Josie still had this in her possession, why it had never been given to its addressee. Had Josie been waiting and forgotten? Had she been angry at Alex for something and decided not to give it at all? Alex stood, then carefully put the box back where she'd found it. She folded the black skirt over her arm and headed toward her own bedroom. Most parents, she knew, went through their children's things in search of condoms and baggies of pot to try to catch them in the act. For Alex, it was different. For Alex, going through Josie's possessions was a way of holding on to everything she had missed. The sad truth about being single was that Patrick couldn't justify going to all the bother to cook for himself. He ate most of his meals standing over the sink, so what was the point of making a mess with dozens of pots and pans and fresh ingredients? It wasn't as if he was going to turn to himself and say, "Patrick, great recipe. Where'd you find it?" He had it down to a science, really. Monday was pizza night, Tuesday, Subway. Wednesday was Chinese, Thursday soup, and Friday he got a burger at the bar where he usually grabbed a beer before heading home. Weekends were for leftovers, and there were always plenty. Sometimes it got downright lonely ordering. Was there any sadder phrase in the English language than poo-poo platter for one? But for the most part, his routine had netted him a collection of friends. Sal at the pizza place gave him garlic knots for free, because he was a regular. The Subway guy, whose name Patrick didn't know, would point at him and grin. "Hearty Italian turkey, cheese, mayo, olives, extra pickles, salt and pepper," he'd call out, the verbal equivalent of their secret handshake. This being a Wednesday, he was at the Golden Dragon, waiting for his takeout order to be filled. He watched May ferry it into the kitchen, where on earth did someone buy a wok that big, he always wondered, and turned his attention to the television over the bar, where the Sox game was just beginning. A woman was sitting alone, tearing a fringe around the edge of a cocktail napkin as she waited for the bartender to bring her her drink. She had her back to him, but Patrick was a detective, and there were certain things he could figure out just from this side of her, like the fact that she had a great ass, for one, and that her hair needed to be taken out of that librarian's bun so that it could wave around her shoulders. He watched the bartender, a Korean named Spike, which always struck Patrick as funny after the first Qingdao, opening up a bottle of Pinot Noir, and he filed away this information, too. She was classy. Nothing with a little paper umbrella in it, not for her. He sidled up behind the woman and handed Spike a 20.
"My treat," Patrick said.
She turned, and for a fraction of a second, Patrick stood rooted to the spot, wondering how this mystery woman could possibly have Judge Cormier's face. It reminded Patrick of being in high school and seeing a friend's mom from a distance across a parking lot and automatically checking her out as a potential hot babe until he realized who it actually was. The judge plucked the $20 bill out of Spike's hand and gave it back to Patrick.
"You can't buy me a drink," she said, and she pulled some cash out of her pocketbook and handed it to the bartender.
Patrick sat down on the stool beside her.
"Well then," he said, "you can buy me one."
"I don't think so."
She glanced around the restaurant.
"I really don't think we ought to be seen talking."
"The only witnesses are the koi in the pond by the cash register. I think you're safe," Patrick said. "Besides, we're just talking. We're not talking about the case. You do still remember how to make conversation outside a courtroom, don't you?"
She picked up her glass of wine.
"What are you doing here, anyway?"
Patrick lowered his voice.
"I'm running a drug bust on the Chinese mafia. They import raw opium in the sugar packets."
Her eyes widened.
"Honestly?"
"No.
And would I tell you if it were true?"
He smiled. "I'm just waiting for my takeout order. What about you?"
"I'm waiting for someone."
He didn't realize, until she'd said it, that he'd been enjoying her company. He got a kick out of flustering her, which, truthfully, wasn't really all that hard. Judge Cormier reminded him of the great and powerful Oz, all bluster and bells and whistles, but when you pulled back the curtain, she was just an ordinary woman who happened to have a great ass. He felt heat rise to his face.
"Happy family," Patrick said.
"Excuse me?"
"That's what I ordered. I was just trying to help you out with that casual conversation thing again."
"You only got one dish? No one goes to a Chinese restaurant and only gets one dish."
"Well, not all of us have growing kids at home."
She traced the lip of her wine glass with one finger.
"You don't have any?"
"Never married."
"Why not?"
Patrick shook his head, smiling faintly.
"I'm not getting into that."
"Boy,"
the judge said,
"she must have done a job on you."
His jaw dropped open. Was he really that easy to read?
"Guess you haven't cornered the market on those amazing detective skills," she said, laughing. "Except we call it women's intuition."
"Yeah, that'll get you your gold shield in no time."
He glanced at her ringless hand.
"Why aren't you married?"
The judge repeated his own answer.
"I'm not getting into that."
She sipped her wine in silence for a moment, and Patrick tapped his fingers on the wood of the bar.
"She was already married,"
he admitted. The judge set her glass down, empty.
"So was he,"
she confessed, and when Patrick turned to her, she looked him right in the eye. Hers were the pale gray that made you think of nightfall and silver bullets and the edge of winter, the color that filled the sky before it was torn in half by lightning. Patrick had never noticed this before, and suddenly he realized why.
You're not wearing glasses.
I sure am glad to know Sterling's got someone as sharp as you protecting and serving them.
You usually wear glasses.
Only when I'm working. I need them to read.
And when I usually see you, you're working.
That was why he hadn't noticed before that Alex Cormier was attractive. Before this, when they crossed paths, she was in full buttoned-up judge mode. She hadn't been curled over the bar like a hothouse flower. She hadn't been quite so human.
Alex!
The voice came from behind them. The man was spiffy, in a good suit and wingtips, with just enough gray hair at his temples to look distinguished. He had lawyer written all over him. He was, no doubt, rich and divorced, the kind of guy who would sit up at night and talk about penal code before making love. The kind of guy who slept on his side of the bed instead of with his arms wrapped so tight around her that even after falling asleep, they stayed tangled.
Jesus Christ, Patrick thought, looking down at the ground. Where did that come from?
What did he care who Alex Cormier dated, even if the guy was practically old enough to be her father?
Whit, she said, I'm so glad you could come.
She kissed him on the cheek and then, still holding his hand, turned to Patrick.
Whit, this is Detective Patrick Ducharme. Patrick, Whit Hobart.
The man had a good handshake, which only pissed Patrick off even more. Patrick waited to see what else the judge was going to say about him by way of introduction. But then, what options did she have? Patrick wasn't an old friend. He wasn't someone she'd met sitting at the bar. She couldn't even say that they were both involved with the Houghton trial, because in that case, he shouldn't have been talking to her. Which, Patrick realized, is what she'd been trying to tell him all along. May appeared from the kitchen, holding a paper bag folded and neatly stapled.
Here you go, Pat, she said. We see you next week, okay?
He could feel the judge staring.
Happy family, she said, offering a consolation prize, the smallest of smiles.
Nice seeing you, Your Honor, Patrick said politely.
He threw the door of the restaurant open so hard that it banged on its hinges against the outside wall. He was halfway to his car when he realized he wasn't even really hungry anymore. The lead story on the local news at 11 p.m. was the hearing at the Superior Court to get Judge Cormier removed from the case. Jordan and Selena sat in bed in the dark, each with a bowl of cereal balanced on their stomachs, watching the tearful mother of a paraplegic girl cry into the television camera.
No one's speaking for our children, she said. If this case gets messed up because of some legal snafu, well, they aren't strong enough to go through it twice.
Neither's Peter, Jordan pointed out.
Selena put down her spoon.
Cormier's gonna sit on that case if she has to crawl her way to the bench.
Well, I can't very well get someone to gilhooly her kneecaps, can I?
Let's look at the bright side, Selena said. Nothing in Josie's statement can hurt Peter.
My God, you're right.
Jordan sat up so quickly that he sloshed milk onto the quilt. He set his bowl on the nightstand.
It's brilliant.
What is?
Diana's not calling Josie as a witness for the prosecution because she's got nothing they can use. But there's nothing to stop me from calling her as a witness for the defense.
Are you kidding? You're going to put the judge's daughter on your witness list?
Why not? She used to be Peter's friend. He's got precious few of them. It's all in good faith.
You wouldn't really...
Nah,
I'm sure I'll never use her. But the prosecutor doesn't need to know that.
He grinned at Selena.
And incidentally, neither does the judge.
Selena set her bowl aside, too. If you put Josie on your witness list, Cormier has to step down.
Exactly.
Selena reached forward, bracketing his face with her palms to plant a kiss on his lips.
You're awfully good.
What was that?
You heard me the first time.
I know, Jordan grinned, but I wouldn't mind hearing it again.
The quilt slipped down as he wrapped his arms around her.
Greedy little thing, aren't you?
Selena murmured.
Isn't that what made you fall in love with me?
Selena laughed. Well, it wasn't your charm and grace, honey. Jordan leaned over her, kissing Selena until, he hoped, she had forgotten she was in the throes of making fun of him.
Let's have another baby, he whispered.
I'm still nursing the first one.
Then let's practice having another one.
There was no one in the world quite like his wife, Jordan thought. Statuesque and stunning, smarter than he was, not that he'd ever admit it to her face, and so perfectly attuned to him that he nearly had to concede his skepticism and believe that psychics truly did walk among us. He buried his face in the spot he loved best on Selena, the part where the nape of her neck ran into her shoulder, where her skin was the color of maple syrup and tasted even sweeter.
Jordan, she said, do you ever worry about our kids? I mean, you know, doing what you do and seeing what we see?
He rolled onto his back.
Well, he said, that certainly killed the moment.
I'm serious.
Jordan sighed.
Of course I think about it. I worry about Thomas and Sam, and whoever else might come along.
He came up on an elbow so that he could find her eyes in the dark.
But then, I figure that's the reason we had them. How so?
He looked over Selena's shoulder to the blinking green eye of the baby monitor.
Maybe, Jordan said, they're the ones who'll change the world.
Wit hadn't really made up Alex's mind for her. That had already been done when she met him for dinner. But he'd been the salve she needed for her wounds, the justification she was afraid to give herself.
You'll get another big case eventually,
he had said.
You won't get back this moment with Josie.
She walked into Chambers briskly, mostly because she knew that this was the easy part. Divorcing herself from the case, writing the motion to recuse herself, that wasn't nearly as terrifying as what would happen tomorrow when she was no longer the judge on the Houghton case. When instead, she had to be a mother. Eleanor was nowhere to be found, but she'd left Alex the paperwork on her desk. She sat down and scanned it. Jordan McAfee, who yesterday hadn't even opened his mouth at the hearing, was noticing up his intention to call Josie as a witness. She felt a fire spark in her belly. It was an emotion Alex didn't even have words for, the animal instinct that came when you realized someone you love has been taken hostage. McAfee had committed the grievous sin of dragging Josie into this, and Alex's mind spiraled wildly as she wondered what she could do to get him fired, or even disbarred. Come to think of it, she didn't even really care if retribution came within the confines of the law or outside it. But suddenly, Alex stilled. It wasn't Jordan McAfee she'd chased to the ends of the earth. It was Josie. She'd do anything to keep her daughter from being hurt again. Maybe she should thank Jordan McAfee for making her realize that she already had the raw material in her to be a good mother after all. Alex sat down at her laptop and began to type. Her heart was hammering as she walked out to the clerk's desk and handed the sheet of paper to Eleanor.
But that was normal, wasn't it, when you were about to leap off a cliff?
You need to call Judge Wagner, Alex said.
It wasn't Patrick who needed the search warrant.